speaking part is quick today because I want to go back over circular arguments. I think we went through those very quickly on Saturday. So we'll deal with the speaking part briefly. It's a short lesson today, and then go on. The main point in our topic for today is that good speaking, good communication is natural. It's natural. Sometimes we hear a lecture and a devotee has a lecture voice. So, we're all very happy to have you with us here today to take part in our Sunday festival. Lord Krishna, as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, He wanted everyone to surrender to Him, but we can understand, and like that, on and on. You know, it breaks everything up into little fragments of six words, and within those six words, each six word fragment is exactly the same as the next, and the next, and the next, and the next. Now, He wouldn't talk to one person that way. He'd talk with expression, He'd talk sometimes quickly and sometimes slowly, and sometimes His voice would go up and sometimes down. Sometimes He'd gesture, sometimes He'd look at you puzzled, sometimes He'd look at you angry. But when He gets an audience on His hands, it's a different story. So we can understand. So there's a story in Dale Carnegie's book about Mark Twain, the author. He was visiting some Nevada mining town. And to make a few bucks, what he'd do is go on lecture tours. He'd write his books, and I guess authors weren't so well paid. So he'd travel and lecture. So he was lecturing in Nevada, and afterwards one of the miners came up to him and said, "Sir, be them your natural tones of eloquence." So that's what we're looking for, is your natural tones of eloquence. Previously, it was the style, and it was expected, that speakers would speak in a very impressive, oratorical voice. That went out with Rome. Now, we have microphones, we have first-class speaker systems, and what they allow you to do, and what people look for, is your natural conversational voice, amplified. Just bigger, enlarged. The same pacing is there, the same variations in your voice, the same everything, just made bigger. So what it means is that you want to speak naturally. But that's hard. Any kid, you can put him on the stage, 6-year-old kid, and he'll speak naturally. But any adult, 20-year-old or more, 15-year-old, he gets all frozen and he starts acting like a marionette and speaking like Robert the Robot. "I'm Robert the Robot, the mechanical man." There was such a robot at that time. So that we have to overcome, and it simply takes practice. It simply takes practice. It's not anything you have to learn. You already know how to speak this way. It's just that we have to unlearn all the ways that we learn to speak publicly or formally. Okay? Let's see if there are minor points. You want to communicate with people. It means you're looking at them, not staring or burning them up with your, like Muchakunda, with your glance. But you're conscious that they're there, and that the reason you're there is to speak to them, to get some input from them by seeing how people are sitting. You can see they're fidgeting, they're getting tired, it's time to wrap things up. Or they're in rapt attention, or they've missed a point, I have to go back over that. You learn things by seeing how people are hearing. And they get something by seeing how you're speaking to them. We want that. That's called communication. This is interesting. Pause before and after important ideas. Someone come up and read this. Here. Here's a purport. Read it. Last one on 621. Right.
Pause before that. One who is engaged in Lord Krishna's devotional service lives in direct relationship with the Supreme Lord. So there is no doubt that his position is transcendental from the very beginning. A devotee does not live on the material plane. He lives with Krishna. The holy name of the Lord and the Lord are non-different. Therefore, when a devotee chants Hare Krishna, Krishna and his internal potency are dancing on the tongue of the devotee. When he offers Krishna food, Krishna directly accepts those edibles. And the devotee becomes Krishnaized by eating events. One who does not engage in such service cannot understand how this is so. Although this is the process recommended in the Bhagavad Gita and other Vedic literatures.
It's a good one, isn't it? It's a 12th chapter, text 8. Any feedback about that? How it affected you? What worked, what didn't work? What could have been better? Someone else, Sureshra, read the same verse. Yeah, he did. He did a good job. Someone else, read the same purport. Go ahead. Ramanuja. Bottom of 621.
One who is engaged in Lord Krishna's devotional service lives in a direct relationship with the Supreme Lord. So there is no doubt that his position is transcendental from the very beginning. A devotee does not live on the material plane. He lives with Krishna. The holy name of the Lord and the Lord are not different. Therefore, when a devotee chants Hare Krishna, Krishna and his internal potency are dancing on the tongue of the devotee. When he offers Krishna food, Krishna directly accepts these edibles, and the devotee becomes Krishna-eyed by eating the remnants. One who does not engage in such service cannot understand how this is so, although this is a process recommended in the Bhagavad Gita and in other Vedic literatures.
Good. A different voice, different person, different way of seeing things. Any feedback? Okay. According to what you want, actually, if you read these purports, there's each word has meaning, and you can pull meaning according to what you see by the way you read it. One who is engaged in Lord Krishna's devotional service, not just ordinary service, one who is engaged in Lord Krishna's devotional service lives in a direct relationship with Krishna. Or, one who is engaged in Lord Krishna's devotional service lives in a direct relationship with the Supreme Lord. So there's no doubt that his position is transcendental from the very beginning. A devotee does not live on the material plane. He lives with Krishna. If I want to emphasize that it's him, or he lives with Krishna. If I want to emphasize Krishna. The holy name of the Lord and the Lord are non-different. Therefore, when a devotee chants Hare Krishna, Krishna and his internal potency are dancing on the tongue of the devotee. Dancing. If you just read it, Krishna and his internal potency are dancing on the tongue of the devotee. Okay. But if you stop and say, Krishna and his internal potency are dancing on the tongue of the devotee. You're serving Prabhupada better. That's the point. It's not artificial. You don't have to do anything extraordinary, no oratorical tones. But if you were saying it, if they were your words, and if you were in a conversation with someone, you'd really try and get that across. He's dancing Krishna's dancing on your tongue. So when you read in the Bhagavatam class, or when you speak in the Bhagavatam class, or in any other class, take your time. You don't have to rush through the purport or through your own sentences. It will have effect. When Arjuna was speaking, was it artificial? Did it strike you? And he put on a good show there. He knew what we were looking for, so he went through special pains to emphasize words and pull them out. Did it hurt? Was it artificial? Did it make you think that he was a big show-off? Or that he was trying to be an orator?
No, it came off very well.
Came off well. So do it. These are simple techniques. They're not even techniques. They're anti-techniques. They're getting rid of the stuff that stops you from doing what you ordinarily do. One other point. Gesturing is also natural. I'd like to point... Who attended the Bhagavatam class this morning? So, one thing I noted about the speaker is that his gesturing was very strong. Did you notice that? When he was speaking, are there any Italians here? Okay, so you know the Italians, they can't talk without their hands. Even they, if they're having a telephone conversation, still they'll use their hands. Right? Almost.
I think he's Italian.
He has an Italian background.
I don't know, but I guess...
He's either an Italian or an honorary Italian. Italians have, and many European countries, but especially in Italy, it's very pronounced that the hands are used. And factually speaking, if you do use your hands in a natural way, not just to make a show, but if you genuinely express yourself with your hands, not only does it make your point stronger because people are seeing that you mean it, but actually you'll speak stronger. Because you're allowing yourself to gesture, the gestures will dictate to you that you have to speak more strongly, more clearly, more powerfully. It's natural.
I feel very much for us. It's very good speaking
with
his hands.
All that energy, use it. Any questions? Okay. Yes.
Sometimes you're speaking to a group and they may have different mentalities, different intellectual levels. I guess you just have to be expert in how to accommodate everyone.
Yes. But generally the rule is speak to the bottom. Speak to the bottom. Make yourself so clear that the thickest man in your audience will understand what you mean. And the cultured persons, intellectual persons, they'll be right with you. For example, in writing, journalism, the journalism schools and the journalists' publications have done a lot of research about what people read and what people like to read. And they can tell you in any given passage of prose what level of person can read that. This is 4 year college prose, this is high school graduate prose, this is 2 years of college prose, this is dropout prose, this is fourth grade reader. And generally what they tell you is that the person who can read on the college level prefers to read at the high school level. Okay? He can read and understand clearly something that's written for a man with 4 years of college. He prefers to read what's written for a man with 4 years of high school. Because it's easier. He can get what it means more quickly, with less trouble, and be perfectly satisfied with it. And the man with 4 years of high school accordingly likes to read what's meant for the grade school students. So if you aim somewhat below the highest level of your audience, you won't be making a mistake. The professors will very clearly understand what you mean, And the ordinary people will appreciate it that you took the time to explain it. Don't baby them. Don't go over and over and over like they were dimwits. But take pains to make yourself clear.
I'd like to make a comment in this regard. This is praise to Srila Prabhupada, that both in speaking and writing, Prabhupada was able to put all the most difficult concepts of a philosophy of a culture, which is completely foreign, in very clear language, and all the professors love it.
Yeah, that's right. Prabhupada's writing is not overly complicated or technical, and even particularly compared to what Western professors write, it's a breeze. Because Western professors are brought up in Western colleges where they're miseducated to think that the higher the language, the more effective the communication. It's a lie. It's simply a lie. The more clear and plain and direct you can be, the more uncomplicated your language, the better your writing is or the better your speaking is. If you have a need for a technical term, if you have to say, oh, let's see, what's that word Garuda always uses?
Ontology.
Not ontology, this is a great word. I joke with him about it sometimes. No, it's when you consider something in the natural context from which it comes, with sympathy for the subject matter. Hermeneutical. If you have to say hermeneutically speaking, because that's the proper term, and if your audience is a learned audience and they'll understand what hermeneutics is, by all means, say it. Sometimes it means appreciating something from it on its own, in its own environment. In other words, Bhagavad Gita shouldn't be viewed from our Western standpoint. You have to see it as it's understood by the followers of the tradition in order to understand what it actually means. That's hermeneutics. If a word's not clear, or you think it might not be clear, or it's clear to some and not to others, use it for the benefit of those that you want to impress, and then define it for the rest of the folks so they understand what you mean. No harm. Okay. Yes?
If you're reading, sometimes there may be a term, even, say, you're reading a Bhagavad Gita purport, knowledge both phenomenal and noumenal. Mm-hmm. And you may want to go and explain what phenomenal and noumenal means.
Sure.
Actually, sometimes if there's a Sanskrit term, I can understand what they're talking about better than an English translation.
There's no harm with making yourself clear. That's the basic rule. Any other questions? Okay, let's get into some circular arguing. Am I right in assuming that we went through it too quickly last time and it went past most of us? Yes? Let's go over it again. Arguments are like houses. They have roofs and they have pillars. The pillar is what the thing stands on, and the roof is what's standing on it. The roof is your conclusion. Pillars are your reasons. The reasons have to support the conclusions. You can't have a house with the roof on the bottom and the pillars on the top. The roof will not support the pillars. The pillars have to support the roof. Nor can you have a house that looks like this. Pillars support the roof, but the pillars rest on another roof, or rest on the same roof somehow. Some inconceivable kind of building. Reasons supporting conclusions. That's how a good argument looks. If you don't have reasons, you don't have an argument. That's irrational. And if your reasons rest on the conclusions, that's a circular argument. Since some people in any large company are corrupt, it follows that no large company is entirely free from corruption.
Same statement.
It's the same statement, isn't it?
It doesn't really follow.
It
just reiterates.
Right, exactly. That's what a circular argument does. A circular argument is, it's true because it's true. When you finally boil it down, when you finally look at what it's actually saying, it's saying, this is true. And the evidence is that it's true. It's just obviously true. It couldn't be untrue. Anything opposed to it is nonsense. You're simply restating your conclusion again and again and again without reasons.
The example given in the sheet is the man says, how can you show me that this is the real Dhamma Vidya? This is the best
vision.
The man says, because my guru said so.
Right.
And then how do you support your guru all the time? And he says, so in the book. That seems to be a different example than this one.
Okay. This is the authoritative edition, because my guru wrote it. Okay? This is the authoritative edition because my guru wrote it. And how do you know that he's authoritative? If you read the book, you'll see that he's authoritative.
It's a slightly different example than the other one.
It is different, but it goes around. That's the point. The book shows. They're different variations of the same species. And I'll show you some more, too.
I'd like to argue on this point. In favor of the Hare Krishna
devotee. The Hare Krishna devotee also can argue in favor of his point. Even that last one, that any large corporation is corrupt, you can argue for it. But not with that argument.
I'm showing evidence that any
large... Exactly. This question came up at the end of our class Saturday. How do you break a circular argument? When is a circular argument broken? If you've made a circular argument, how do you get out of it?
Then you put some pillars in.
You put some pillars in. As soon as you offer reasons that don't depend on the conclusion, you've broken out of the circle.
It says it in the book. And not only the book, but there's a whole tradition, Guru, Sadhu, Shastra, one supports the other.
That's a different thing. They say, well, yeah, but your guru wrote the book. You say, not what he wrote, it's in the verse. Well, they'll say, well, that's just the way your guru translated. No, look in Dr. Radhakrishnan's Gita also. It says the same thing. Breaks out of the circle. Anybody's Bhagavad Gita, it'll say, you have to approach someone in the parampara system.
If you can't go beyond these few words, you know.
If you just stick with this and say, this is the best book because my guru wrote it, if you read the book, you'll see that he's the right person. You'll see that he's an authority. You're going around. The book's authoritative because my guru wrote it. He's an authority because the book says so. It goes around and around and around. If he's an authority, the book must be true. And if the book is true, he must be an authority. The conclusion is what proves the reason. If the conclusion is not true, then the reason's no good. If my guru is not an authority, this is what we have to prove, that he's an authority. Now, even if he's not an authority, If he's not an authority, if the opposite is true, if the argument is false, in other words, the conclusion is false, still the so-called reason will support it, that it's true. When you read this book, it will show that he's authoritative. If you accept the conclusion. But the conclusion is what we're arguing about. So this is what's to be determined. So you can't give an argument to support it in which his authority is already assumed. In which the conclusion is already assumed. The conclusion is what's to be proved. So any reason, assuming that it's already proven, is no reason. Or it's an invalid reason. You have to give another reason. Well, he's accepted by all the scholars in India. Or he's 33rd person in a line of tradition of accepted teachers. Or his purports say exactly what the translation says, exactly what the verse says. Or he's accepted by all the scholars in the universities and colleges. Or whatever else you want. But not this argument. It goes around and around. Yes, Maharaj.
I'm just going to bring up a common circular argument, and that is that the Bhagavatam is authoritative, because in the Bhagavatam, it tells the story of Vyasadeva.
Right.
And that story shows how the Bhagavatam is authoritative.
It doesn't. Someone want to argue it? Maharaj says that this Bhagavatam is an authoritative Vedic literature. We accept Srimad Bhagavatam as authority. You don't, but we do. And we're arguing that you should accept the Bhagavatam as an authoritative literature. Now his argument is that if you read in the fifth chapter, first canto, you'll find out how Vyas himself came to be the author of this literature. And because he's the author, you should accept Bhagavatam. That's his argument. I don't like it. Someone argue against it. You should all be prepared to argue against it.
Because he wrote it in the future.
What's that? Let's hear your argument.
I'm just giving, because that story shows that Vyasadeva wrote all the Vedas, but he wrote the Bhagavatam for maturity of his.
Anyone who's given thought to it says such and such thing because. One more. Flag waving. It's on the second sheet. Appeal to patriotism.
I didn't get that sheet as it turns out.
You argue that to see things any other way but my way is un-American. Or it's against the spirit of this body. Or it's just, it's a non-Vaishnav way of seeing things. Or it's just not the ISKCON mood. Or on and on and on. It's another kind of intimidation. If you're not with us, you're against us. And if you see things other than the way I see things, you're not with us. One man I was talking to, one devotee said, I want to train these boys in the ISKCON mood. Our schools should train these boys in the ISKCON mood. I said, fine, which ISKCON mood do you mean? He was trying to push through that it should be seen, they should be trained the way he had in mind, because that was the ISKCON mood. But there are lots of ISKCON moods, not just his. Reasons. We have to stand up for ISKCON. Fine. But does that mean that we have to follow your policy? Or that we should examine your policy and see whether it's the best one for ISKCON or not? Sure, we all agree. Let's all stand up for ISKCON, let's all stand up for Prabhupada. Now, what's the best policy for doing that? Not just because you're standing up and waving the flag, your idea must be right. If your idea is backed up with the best reasons, then it's right. If it's not, then all the flag waving in the world won't make you right. Okay? Ready for some more speeches? Yes, Mamadev. Pardon me? Could you speak up a little louder? Sargal Singh is dead. You don't know. Who knows that story? Tell it. Come up front and tell it.
We've told it before, read it in quite a while. In the Prabhupada Nectar series, the story is told. Prabhupada tells a story that once there was a merchant who his acquaintances in the neighborhood saw that he had shaved his head and was wearing the cloth in mourning, which is traditionally just like Prabhupada when his father disappeared. He shaved his head in mourning for his father. So he told the persons who questioned him, "Oh, Sargal Singh is dead." So they said, "Oh, Sargal Singh is dead." So others started to adapt the shaving and wearing the cloth of mourning. So the word spread around, all around the town, that Sargal Singh is dead. And it became quite a topic for everyone. And finally the word got back that someone actually questioned, "Well, then who is this Sargal Singh?" And they went to the man who had originally shaved his head. "As though, Sargal Singh, he is my mule. He is my pet mule." And so in this way, by just listening to the hearsay or just assuming and not really getting the facts in the matter, everyone actually had made asses of themselves. So that's the story of Sargal Singh.
Good. Comments? I liked your ending. I don't think Prabhupada had given that ending, but it was very sharp. That's the way to end. A good sharp line that leaves people with the message, or leaves them laughing, or leaves them thinking, or leaves them ready to act. Everyone had actually made asses of themselves. Great ending. Very good. It's a very good story. And I've heard it told with considerably more drama.
I have no details, just kidding.
If I'd given you more time, or if you'd had a chance to reread it, it can be told with considerable drama about how the man was lamenting and weeping. And when the people came up to him and asked him what had happened, he told them, "Sargal Singh is dead." "Who's Sargal Singh?" "Oh, he's the greatest friend that anyone ever had. And now he's dead." Then the other people also, they were so affected that they began weeping. "Sargal Singh, you mean Sargal Singh?" "Yes." Finally it came up to the king. That's the story, as it came up to the king. The minister shaved his head and everybody shaved his head. The king saw that his whole kingdom, everybody's shaving their heads and weeping. Finally, the word goes back down the line. The minister asks the governor, and the governor asks the mayor, and the mayor asks. Finally, they come back to the washerman. "Who's Sargal Singh?" "Sargal Singh. My ass, Sargal Singh." "So faithful." The public is an ass.
That really illustrate, if you're going to use that in a bridging situation, that story, but does it actually illustrate the fact of
it? It illustrates that people have a tendency to accept without questioning that which has no legitimate value. We quoted George Orwell the other day. He invented a term for it, groupthink. Groupthink. And it's a very powerful force.
It's like the American dream, something like that.
any dream. Any dream. And it's been, there's been quite a bit of research done on it. Groupthink. The ability of a majority to bring others into line. It's a very strong force. Okay.